here we are back again for the first recording of the new year, and welcome back everyone, and hopefully you are all caught up on the previous episodes that we've got online and ready for some new stuff.
Absolutely, welcome back. Here's to 2024.
Let's hope it's a better year than some of the last couple have been for various reasons. Today we are going to talk about vulnerability. Now, we have to preface this conversation with the, I guess, the caveat that when we talk about vulnerability, it's a very emotional topic. Anytime you talk about, say, victims of crime, victim behaviours, it really starts to hit some chords with people. Some people get very defensive about it. I've been personally accused of victim blaming a number of times when that's the last thing on my mind because of the way it's viewed. And I think I've said it in a previous episode that when you're like Grant or myself, or, you know, being a criminologist and looking at crime related stuff, we can't afford to be too precious because we have to understand the situation that's gone on. In a therapy situation, if you don't understand what's gone on, why the person's there, you're not going to be able to help them. And the same for me, if I'm writing a report on what's happened and I don't try to account for all of the behaviours, then I'm actually not doing my job properly because one, I'm not being thorough, but two, there's going to be parts of my understanding that are going to be missing. And so we have to, try to walk away from this idea that any time we talk about a victim or something a victim's done, that we're blaming the victim. We're not. That's the last thing on our mind. I've said to somebody in the past, how many victims have you worked with? And they said, none. I said, well, I work with victims pretty regularly, and I don't think I've blamed a single one of them for anything that's befallen them, because it's not productive, it's not helpful. So when we talk about vulnerability, we are really talking about personality, social, cultural features that a person has that influence what happens to them.
That's it. I think vulnerability is a very misunderstood and misaligned kind of topic when we talk about particularly interpersonal crime. Mm. But if we take it out of even that space for a second, the notion of vulnerability is simply a characteristic that in some way allows a predator to see you as potential prey. Yeah, so that's all it is. And if you look at, say, someone who has wealth, as an example, the fact that they have wealth means that they are attractive to a predator who is after some kind of financial scam. So therefore, your wealth, although it, by no means can you say wealth is a weakness or wealth is something to blame you about, it can be seen as a potential vulnerability because it attracts someone who has an ulterior motive.
A particular type of person.
And that's the key. So that's an external kind of factor, if you like, wealth. There are lots of other external factors that contribute to our vulnerability, the laws of the land, the cultural factors, the history of the space. There's a whole range of things that come into that environment. And then you have the more internal, if you like, or closer to home types of personal vulnerabilities about your own characteristics, your education level, your status, and all of those kinds of things.
Emotional state, mental state.
Aspects of agency come into vulnerability. Mm. And that's something that is again, sort of very fraught because of the notion of what that means to different people. Mm. And that's an interesting conversation I've had with some of my international colleagues. We're working in the global south, and we're working in places like Nigeria and Pakistan and Egypt and India and these kinds of places, where the notion of agency, the notion of women's rights, the notion of what even is denoted as gender-based violence or other factors around that are really open for conversation, even interpretation of just the language we use. I think you're absolutely right. This is a topic I think we're going to do a number of podcasts on over time.
I can think of at least half a dozen where we can go down various pathways.
Pathways on this. And it is a particular passion of mine. So, I talk about vulnerability in almost any context that we'll talk about in this podcast. So there will be lots of different ways that we're going to explore it. But I think we've got to really preface right up front that in no way is this victim blaming. In fact, some of our greatest strengths as human beings, as an individual, can, in the hands of a skilled predator, be one of our greatest vulnerabilities.
Absolutely.
If you are a person who is very trusting or very loving or just wants to help other people, in the hands of a skilled predator, that can be manipulated.
It can be turned against you.
Absolutely.
And that's when a strength, a personality strength, becomes a vulnerability.
And so when we talk about vulnerabilities, one of the things that I do a lot in my clinical practice, in presentations and books and all of these things, and in fact, I'm writing a book right now with a colleague from the UK about this very topic. One of the things I go to great pains about talking about is education and knowledge. Because when you know that some aspect of you or your environment or factors around you could make you vulnerable, you are empowered almost instantly to act to somehow mitigate that. To what extent is, again, a big variable, but knowledge is power. And, you know, that's a Absolutely. That's a statement that you hear all the time in different contexts. Knowledge is power. Education is power. When you have it, you have some sense of control over outcomes. If we don't accept that, then we're left with the idea that says that it's outside of our control.
There's nothing, literally nothing we can do, so why bother trying?
We place the responsibility on someone else, which by default then takes the capacity from us. And that's not what we want to do. We want to say, we have the opportunity to do something about our circumstance. We have the opportunity, to the extent possible, we know we're not going to fix the world's ills by simply being aware of them, but that's the starting point.
And I think in a way, if we can, you've used the word education there, I think it's probably a good general term to use for it. We can, what we do know of certain things, we can actually blunt the impact or the intrusion of certain things by telling people that, hey, look, if this happens, this is what it means. We do this with conspiracy theories. I did this myself just at the start of the COVID panic. Okay, everybody, this is what we're going to start to see. We're going to see this myth, this myth, this myth, this myth. This is what it means. Here's what it looks like. Here's why you don't believe it. So we can educate people or give people enough information so that they either make better choices or so that they're more aware when things are actually happening to them.
I think that's a really good point. I like COVID's a really good analogy. Wearing seatbelts in a car is another analogy that we've talked about before. When we acknowledge that not washing our hands, that invading individuals' personal spaces and the such are things that make us vulnerable to COVID or to illness in general, we are empowered to socially distance. We're empowered to wash our hands with warm soapy water regularly and all of those things.
20 seconds.
All those things that we heard about during COVID. When we recognize that going through the front windscreen of a car at 200 miles an hour when we have, two cars hitting at 100K each is probably potentially worse for your health than staying in situ with a seatbelt.
With a seatbelt on.
The vulnerability to flying out the windscreen gets reduced. And we have the control or some, at least partial control, over the outcomes that might happen in an accident for us. So these are things that are vulnerabilities.
And
the
funny thing is with the seatbelt example, I've never really heard anyone say, oh, well, you're just a shill for big automotive.
Yeah.
We recognize that that is a very simple, common sense and effective measure to prevent injury when we're in a car crash.
Absolutely. I have never heard ever when someone hasn't been wearing a seatbelt in an accident and it's resulted in a bigger injury, when someone said they weren't wearing a seatbelt and this has contributed to some of the injuries. I've never heard someone say you're victim blaming. Never heard that come out of their mouth. You have 7 people in a household that have COVID and you choose unmasked and unprotected to walk into the middle of them and give them a big hug, I've never heard someone say, well, when you should have probably protected yourself, I've never heard someone say you're victim blaming.
You got COVID and you only wash your hands for 5 seconds, so
it's your fault.
It's your fault.
Um, I've never heard someone use victim blaming in those contexts before, and we could go on and on and on about that.
Ad nauseam.
And I think when we recognise that this is not about victim blaming, that vulnerability or recognising what makes us vulnerable to an outcome, whatever that outcome might be, we get to take power from that, we get to take control from that, and we get to then be in a position of choice to some extent. Yeah, there's you never have 100% control over an environment. It's a co-creation with the rest of society we live in and the factors. But the more we are aware, the more choice and control we've got, the better we are to mitigate the vulnerabilities that we may have as an individual human being against whatever that might be.
Whatever happens, yeah.
In this context, we're talking about, I guess, more characteristics of interpersonal crime type of space. But that equally is true of, bank frauds and whatever else it might be.
Just to sort of tack on the end of that, I was thinking, the one I always think of when I think of vulnerabilities is financial hardship, because it's probably one of the most common and most pervasive vulnerabilities out there. Because especially now, you know, the big buzz phrase at the moment is cost of living crisis. So times are tight for a lot of people. But I've never looked at a victim of a financial scam, like a Nigerian prince needs $8,000 to release $2 million into your account, and gone, oh, well, that was your fault because you're poor. You just don't do that. No. But what you can say to somebody is, look, your financial situation at the moment perhaps opened you up to that type of scam. So here's what you look out for in the future. So we can actually turn that from almost an accusatory conversation when we victim blame into something that's constructive and helpful.
Absolutely.
That person goes, next time they're in that situation, they can go, oh, this is exactly what Grant talked about. This is exactly what Wayne talked about. I'm not going to fall for it this time.
I can be more aware.
Yeah.
And therefore, forewarned is forearmed.
Absolutely.
I think that's a really important, really important point.
We do it with cults. They do it with educating children in schools about what does a cult look like? How does a cult recruit? How are they going to target you? We do it with a lot of things.
I think public awareness type campaigns are exactly this. We live on the Gold Coast, the single highest rates of skin cancer on the planet.
A brand new ad on TV at the moment.
What are we talking about? Slip, slop, slap. All of these kinds of statements, because if we don't, we're vulnerable to exposure to UV.
If the UV is above 3, slip, slop, slap. That's the message.
The new message.
Yep.
So they are recognising that we are vulnerable to the negative effects of the sun. Look both ways before you cross the road. You're vulnerable to the damage a car might do if they hit you.
Yep.
How do you protect yourself from that vulnerability? Be aware of it. And now we can mitigate
it. Cross the lines.
That's exactly right. So I think all of those things are, you know, without being facetious about the very real factor of, unfortunately, people have blamed victims in the past. And when we talk about things particularly like gender-based violence, and we talk about violence against vulnerable minorities, one of the messaging, the very powerful ways that the counter-messaging comes across from those who would be the potential abusers, and I use that term, or the predators in a very broad context, is to blame the victim.
Absolutely. Yeah.
To you know, other them, and we talked about otherization. You know, they are just lazy, they are just whatever, they deserve
stupid,
it, they did this,
gullible.
Whatever it is. That's not what this is about, and we've got to at every turn counter that, defend against that, argue against that, reject that outright. What we don't want to do is throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, because people have done this inappropriately, incorrectly, we are not going to explore what may make us vulnerable in that context.
Yeah.
And how do we manage that?
And I think we have a lot to thank the early victimologists for, because they did the foundational work. But the reason we're here today talking about this is basically largely because of them, because the early victimologists were talking people like Stephen Schaefer, Benjamin Mendelsohn, Hans von Hentig, the early victimologists way back in the day when it was still a very fledgling sort of discipline. they were, most of them were lawyers, and their victim types were designed to give them a bit of a sliding scale of culpability for the offenders. Yep. And they even had a type which was, you know, the completely innocent victim, and then you had the precipitated victim that is basically responsible, in their language, for their own harm or loss. And so we're really here having a conversation 100 years down the track from some of this early work, or some 50, 60 years in some of the other work. And this is why we're having this conversation today. And I think if we can move past that, then we're going to have much more informed discussions, but we're also going to be able to empower people to, so they have more of that agency, they have more of that control over what happens to them.
Absolutely. It gives us the ability to map the direction forward to reduce the risks.
Mm-hmm. And realistically, while we're talking about vulnerability, and we sort of use that as a general term to describe a lot of situations, we can have different vulnerabilities at different times in our life. I might have financial hardship today, but I win the $200 million Powerball on Thursday and money's no longer a problem for me, sort of thing. So we're not talking about rigid or fixed. We may be, but not in every situation will these vulnerabilities be rigid and fixed. We move through different stages of our life. We have contact with different people. We have different experiences. We might work in different jobs. All of these things will change our vulnerabilities as we progress through our years.
Absolutely. I agree. And it's interesting that there are, when we move on to talk about specific types of vulnerabilities and how they present, there are lots of similarities across cultures, across ethnic groups, across socioeconomic groups of vulnerability. It is very similar, irrespective of a number of our individual circumstances, but the way it manifests, the way it expresses itself, if you like, in different circumstances is quite different. We can look at somewhere like Pakistan. It's ranked, I think, 153rd out of 156 countries for the place where women are treated poorly. So
it's not on any of their tourism brochures.
No, it's not. It's not a women's rights tourist destination, shall we say? And I've had that conversation with female human rights lawyers in Pakistan, and heard stories firsthand about that with the work that I'm doing in the Global South. However, we've had this same conversation about women's vulnerabilities and risk around Parliament House in Australia in the last few years.
Yes, they're
exactly the same. The last Olympics, we had a women's volleyball team from arguably some of the most gender rights advanced countries in the planet. We're talking about the Scandinavian countries, where the women were being lambasted because they were refusing to wear the skimpy beach volleyball, the volleyball uniforms.
Right. Yeah, I remember that.
And they were fined and so forth, you know, over something like this. So it's interesting that, you know, those kinds of notions, doesn't matter where we are, there is a risk and a vulnerability that comes inherent too, but how it expresses itself can look very different.
So the vulnerabilities are pretty universal. It's just the way they look.
That's it.
That changes according to social, cultural factors.
Yeah.
And a lot of this stuff, a lot of what we're talking about here is not necessarily about, and this is actually really important, whether we're talking about victim precipitation or vulnerabilities or whatever the topic of conversation is around that victim, that idea of victimology or victimization, we're not necessarily talking about the way things are. Sometimes we are talking about the way they're perceived to be by another person, and that's something we can't control. Just to use an example, I remember the Jodie Foster movie, the name of which escapes me, but she gets raped in a bar, and it's all
the
about
accused.
How she was dressed, while she was behaving provocatively and stuff like that. But as far as I'm concerned, you should be able to wear, as long as what you're wearing is legal, you should be able to wear whatever you want down the street and not have another person look at you and think that's some type of invitation. But the reality is, there are people who will interpret things like skimpy clothing behavior as an invitation to some unwanted behaviors. So it's not necessarily about what we're doing, it's about sometimes about what another person perceives that we're doing and why we're doing it.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. I guess the question of vulnerability isn't simply, and we will do this, we'll talk about within vulnerability what it looks like and how it manifests. But I think ultimately the bigger conversation is, what do we do? What do we do with our knowledge?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, why the conversation is so important for us to have this. And I know where everyone listening to this, we're prefacing a lot here, and we're probably using multiple metaphors to reinforce the same thing. But I think it's very, very important to establish this really clearly, that we understand vulnerability so that we can mitigate it, so that we can empower people. And this comes down to the notion of agency. It comes down to the notion of, how do we put control back in the hands of the individual,
the person,
so that they have the agency to make choice?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And if we make informed choice, if we are consciously choosing an action, we have control over that. I think that's the important point here.
Yep. I think it's a very good point to make, because the idea that we're totally helpless and totally powerless and totally at the mercy and whim of other people is not anywhere near reality. And there is a lot of choice, to use that word, that we can make, which will put us in harm's way or move us out of harm's way. And being able to give people that power, that knowledge, that understanding to make those better choices that move them away from harm, I don't know how there's a valid argument anyone could make against that.
I agree. I love one of the models that I use a lot in clinic, and I use a lot when I'm having conversations with people about the notion of empowerment, the notion of choice, is a model called the conscious competency model, or the competency model in general. And the competency model basically says we have four states of being. So we often start out being unconsciously incompetent. We don't know that we don't know something. We don't know that there is a vulnerability. We don't know that something is not as it should be, if you like, or we don't have the information. Then something happens that allows us to be aware. So we start off being consciously unconsciously incompetent. We don't know that we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Someone gives us information and we become aware that we don't know. So now we become consciously incompetent, not unconsciously incompetent. We now know that we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's at that point that we can hopefully be disturbed by that notion enough to motivate us to do something about it.
That's the whole idea behind the imposter syndrome, is you know so much, you realize there's so much you don't know, and you feel like you're a bit of a hack.
Need to know more, yeah. So when we're consciously incompetent, we move towards understanding solutions to that circumstance. We eventually then become consciously competent. So now we know what we know, we've learnt it, but we have to act very deliberately to have agency to utilise it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something we go, okay, you know, I've just learnt to walk, I need to put left foot, right foot, left foot, right foot. Yep, we're consciously thinking about those steps and being aware at all times of doing it. Over time, that then becomes a unconsciously competent motion, and mm-hmm. driving is probably a really good example of this process. You know, we're a 15-year-old or a 16-year-old, and we go to get our license. We know, we don't know what we don't know. We watch our parents drive, and we think, oh, it's got to be that easy. And I can remember as a kid jumping in and pretending to drive the car, and all I thought it was just moving the steering wheel around, and didn't know any better.
Yep.
Then you suddenly get behind the wheel, or, you know, your first time behind the wheel, and you realize, oh my goodness, I don't know what I'm doing. You become consciously incompetent.
So many different things to take into account.
So you learn, and you become consciously competent. You've got to think indicator on now, clutch in, clutch out, brake on, all those things.
Mm.
Eventually, and now 35, nearly 40 years later of driving, I don't really think a lot about what I do behind the wheel. I'm unconsciously competent with a lot of it. And we get into that almost automaticity, sort of automaton action, where we get in the car and we go for a drive, and suddenly we're 2 hours down the road and we go, oh, here I am.
You know, we leave work and we're pulling into the driveway at home. We don't remember the drive at all.
We don't remember because we become, in some ways, unconsciously competent. Mm. Now, this leads to the final thing to be really careful about, is that if we don't regularly reflect and check and touch bases, and when we're talking about vulnerabilities, this is where it's not about coming up with one factor and one knowledge and never looking at it again. We've got to constantly reflect about the changing attitudes, the changing circumstances in the world we live in, because unconscious competence leads to unconscious incompetence, because we slowly move away from realizing we need to know something. And that's where, if we use the driving analogy, it's not about being automatically competent at what we're doing. We lose focus, we lose attention, and we drive into the car.
And we have an exit.
So we go through the red light. So we've got to maintain reflective competency. We've got to maintain reflective evaluation. That's the conversation we need to have about things like vulnerability and like mitigation and how we manage it in a society and as individuals.
And we can be relatively well inoculated against something, but that can change too over time. If you encounter a, you might have received all the Nigerian Prince emails and realize that there is no Nigerian Prince who's willing to give you $2 million from some gold mine that he sold. But criminals, people who behave in antisocial ways are very, very good at harnessing current, whether it be current affairs, the current political state. The example I'll give of this is COVID. I had a number of people say to me, I've just got an email saying that I'm due for my COVID shot, and that to secure my place, to secure my particular vaccine, I've got to go and pay $25, and that guarantees me the vaccine. And I said, well, you don't have to pay anything because the vaccines are being rolled out for free. This is a scam. They're just trying to get your money. Oh, but they only want $25. Well, if they catch 1,000 people, that's $25,000. So what happened was you've got people who are probably aware that the Nigerian prince was a scam, but all of a sudden now we're in this situation where we can potentially get infected with this quite deadly disease, and we almost override our caution because I'd rather be protected. And if it's only going to cost me $25 to be protected, then I'm willing to take that chance.
Absolutely. And that really highlights where vulnerability has those two components, the external component of the environmental factors around us. Mm-hmm. So in this case, COVID, maybe some media around limited access to vaccines or whatever it might be, which then provides an environment of vulnerability.
This vaccine is no longer a candidate because it doesn't triggers HIV or whatever.
Absolutely. And there are so many ways that can be mined through our internet searches and Facebook searches and things. We might search, effective vaccines. So suddenly you get the scan that says we're the only ones that have still got the mRNA vaccine or whatever it might be.
We've still got stock.
That's it. So that's the vulnerability of the environmental circumstances. And then you've got the individual vulnerability of the characteristics of who you are and the way you think and see things in terms of what that leads to, the vulnerability that you might take advantage of that. Yeah. You know, individual fears of, and if I'm a germaphobe, I might, I see this as an opportunity to guarantee that I'm good or whatever it might be. And those two elements, the confluence of those two things come together. Being aware of that means that me as an individual can go, oh, this looks really good. Maybe I'll take advantage of this. Or, hang on, what's going on? What am I doing? I can explore that. And I can access my confederates, my friends, my family, and go, oh, I got this. And then your friend says, oh, dude, you're being scammed. Yeah. Mm. And you've got that other voice of reason that might help you in that context.
Yep.
So that is something that we as individuals get to have some control over. Even if someone's trying to influence us, if we're aware that we're vulnerable to that influence, we can act accordingly. The other side of that coin is, the behavior, so we have the vulnerability. The other side is the perpetrator, the predator, as the language I tend to use is this is predatory behavior on the part of somebody else. The predator has an action required to exploit that vulnerability. You can't control that action from that individual. They will do that action irrespective of you.
Regardless, yeah.
It's the accessibility that creates the vulnerability. It's the desirability of you as a victim because of those characteristics. It's the susceptibility you have to, the belief of the message or the scam or of the whatever it might be. They're the things that we want to look at and look at how we can help people to
yep.
to secure against it.
And even you know, being forewarned is being forearmed, I think is the saying. But you can be inoculated very well and still either fall for something or almost fall for something. And I say this speaking out of immediate personal experience of my last trip to the supermarket. I was in a rush and I just wanted to get in and get out. And while I was in there, my phone rang and it was a Western Australian number. And I thought, don't recognise it, but I do know a couple of people in WA. Maybe it's one of them calling. So I answer it. And it's, hi, is this Wayne? And straight away, my hackles go up. I go, warning signs, you know, you've called me. Do you not know who you're calling? So I'm like, and I'm also painfully aware that they can use recorded clips of your voice to do things like online verifications and stuff. So I'm always very careful. I never say, yes, is this Wayne? Yes. Okay. So, because that's very simple. They can take that and use it. So I always say, what is this about and who is calling, please? So give them quite a long, so there's not a snippet they can take out of it. And this woman says, I'm from the technical support department of Gmail. You have a Gmail address, and read the address. And it's a Gmail address I haven't had for years. I haven't used for years. I wouldn't even remember the password for it. And I'm thinking, this woman knows personal details about me. And the part of the email address was actually my birth year. And I'm like, that's a bit specific. Like, how did she... And then she started saying, your email account is being used on Instagram and Tinder, and they're using it to post child pornography pictures. Straight away, I'm thinking, oh my God, that's a crime. And then I start to go, this sounds serious, but is it real? And she's saying all the right things. When I'm asking questions, she's saying all the right things. But then she said, and they're using your mobile number in the United States. And straight away I said, well, how can they do that? The United States has a completely different cellular system. Click, she hung up. As soon as I expressed that doubt, but I have to admit, I was on the hook for a good part of that call up to that point, because she knew personal details. I did in fact have that email address. I hadn't been using it. And she obviously knew that saying to anyone that your mobile number being used in a crime is going to be... what's the word? It's going to get you in the defensive.
It's almost the final sales ploy, if you like, because someone's either going to go, like you did at that moment, no, this is all
and we'll
garbage.
Throw in the window tinting for free.
Yeah, yep. Exactly. Or they go, oh my goodness, and you go, oh, we've got them.
Yep.
Because they don't know that that's not the case. So it's a really great ploy that very few people would necessarily be aware of, that because all we hear about these days is international roaming and whatever else. So we make this assumption that we all use the same mobile phones.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Mm. And that's a really good, one of the issues with vulnerability that we have today for particularly scams, internet scams, telephone scams, they're everywhere. I don't think I would have a day go past where I don't get a text message or an email that isn't
a scam
related. Your password
wouldn't be delivered, please
exactly
reply
right.
to this. Yep.
And I get lots of internet traffic because of our experiences and media and the publications we've written and things. And so I'd get well over 1,000 emails in a day. And I don't know how many of those are scams because I usually just get my collective emails and highlight all and press delete.
It's in the spam folder.
Yeah, exactly right. Everyone knows to contact my assistant, not me, if they need to actually speak to me. But it's a really good highlight that we all have a universal, almost a universal vulnerability to online scams, telephone scams, to do with computers, electronic bank accounts, email addresses. And when it comes to things like Hotmail, Gmail, these kinds of accounts, probably if they're calling someone in Australia, the US, the UK, New Zealand, Canada, these places, and I'm using English speaking just simply because that's my world, 60%, 70% of the people that get on the other end of the line will have had a Hotmail account at some stage.
Absolutely.
Or a Gmail.
Playing the numbers.
Even if it was just the 25-year-old who at some stage somewhere opened up an Xbox account, they had to have a Gmail account because that was the only way you could do it. Or they had to have a Hotmail account because it was the only way you could get onto whatever it might be. because there are a number of those types of accounts with some of those Microsofts and Googles and things you've got to have a particular type of account to have it. I've got a Google email address simply because I couldn't have a Google account way back in the day without it. Now it still sits there on top of all the other ones that I've got. Mm-hmm. So that makes me vulnerable to someone who could exploit that. People are always getting access to those things. There's almost no way to protect your digital footprint today. So it makes us all vulnerable. So unless we are aware of that vulnerability, we can become victims to it. For you, the awareness that it could be a scam, part of your world that you live in, you're aware of these things. But even with that knowledge, there was a hook until.
When she said that about it's being used to child pornography, my mind went straight away to, I don't want to be accused of committing a crime. I don't want to have to deal with this. If it happens, this isn't me. This is some. And my mind shifted from, hang on, this sounds a bit fishy. I went into fight or flight mode. Yeah. I went into that protection defense. Mode. Protection. Absolutely. I went into defense.
Yeah.
And they either have very carefully crafted it that way, or they just happened to stumble upon it and it worked. But I left that situation. I went, nearly got me. Nearly got me.
There's a beautiful example of this, the sort of thing that you're talking about, the electronic scams, if you like, in a movie that's currently at the movies here in Australia called The Beekeeper.
Mm.
And the whole movie is predicated on someone who gets done with an internet scam. And they sort of, there's a scene where this particular individual is taken through the steps and then eventually gets scammed.
Mm.
And it shows how skillful a predator can be with relatively limited amounts of information about you, but there's so much that people can glean from that will you'll without even realizing it start to provide the next step of information they might need because of that vulnerability that we might have. We want to be nice, we want to be helpful, we want to be whatever it might be, we want to believe the best in people, whatever it might be. So I think that's that example of internet scams or electronic scams or whatever we want to call them, that's certainly sort of, we talk about the global north in the developed world and so forth, that's an almost universal vulnerability that we have to those kinds of issues.
And I remember having a conversation a while ago about online shopping. Because, and this became, I'm sure that this will be no stranger to probably 99.9% of the people listening, but online shopping during COVID became the thing. It was how a lot of companies survived. They pivoted from bricks and mortar to, and they did their online stuff. And we were, during COVID, if you're in a lockdown, whatever, you'd sit there staring out the window waiting for the postie to arrive, because that was the most exciting part of the day. That was the highlight of your entire day.
Absolutely. So, folks, let me tell you that just because we're having a podcast about this doesn't mean we're not vulnerable to getting done. My wife's going to listen to this podcast, and if I don't tell this story, she's going to certainly want to make comments on our website. I have been done 3 times with online buying scams. Didn't learn the first time, didn't learn the second time. The third time, my wife just said, you're not allowed to do anything anymore that's not on a very legit site. But I did my homework on these sites. First time, I was very excited. I got an ad through after I'd been looking for electronic scooters, and I thought, I'm going to be a little bit cool and hip and get an electronic scooter. So I was doing some searches, and next thing, they started popping up in my feed everywhere. I got one. Fantastic, this great run-out model, blah, blah, blah. It was about $700. So it wasn't a small amount of money, but it was down from this huge amount. Got on, saw the company, got on their website. It looked beautiful and legit and was all great. And I thought, oh, well, I've done everything I can. This is a legit ad. So I bought it. A couple of weeks later, I got a package in the mail that I wasn't expecting. Small package in the mail, so it wasn't big enough for an electronic scooter. This package in the mail, and I thought, oh, that's interesting, what have I got? And I opened it up, and it was a plastic red lightsaber in 3 parts just stuck together. And that was my $700 American scooter. Yeah. And this is a fantastic, I was vulnerable because this was something I wanted, desired, I did my homework, but obviously not enough. My wife has since taught me there's plenty of sites you can go onto. It'll tell you whether a site's a scam. I know that now. But it was a very interesting So the vulnerability is one thing, and the way that people are, predators are so crafty in doing this.
They are absolutely
because
skillful.
I got something sent to me from China. I got something in the mail. So if I wanted to argue this was fraud, all the company has to do is say, oh, our mistake, we shipped the wrong product to you.
Yep.
We're all out of that product, here's your money back.
Yep.
Now, if they get 50,000 people who want to buy a $5,000 scooter for $700 and 50 of us or 100 of us get our money back, it's still an incredibly good scam, and whoever manufactured the plastic lightsabers made a buck out of it as well.
Yep.
So,
yep.
Now I did that two more times before I finally learnt my lesson. I got two toilet brushes on the other occasions, or a toilet brush and a hairbrush, I think I got on the other occasions. And so ever since, a number of my staff at work, you know, sort of laugh at me whenever I buy something online, even if it's from a legit company, that I'm getting another toilet brush. So the vulnerability to these things are very real.
It is.
It took me three strikes before I learnt my lesson and now do my right searches. And even if it looks awesome and brilliant, I don't go there.
Don't go.
What I tend to go is I tend to swipe right on other sites that I know are legitimate, and they're very legitimate organisations. And even if that looks good online, I'll go and find it somewhere else if I really need it. I'd say vulnerability is not for the weak. Vulnerability is something that even those of us who know this space can become susceptible to if the predator approaches us in a way that exploits those vulnerabilities.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll probably sort of wrap this up soon, because this is a really good introduction to the idea of vulnerability, and it gives us that launch pad to go down, you know, half a dozen different paths. But the idea that, you know, I mean, I know someone who says, I will never fall prey to an online purchase scam. And I said, well, no one can make that claim. And he said, well, I can, because I never buy anything online. So he is sort of inoculating himself in a way against falling for those sort of online scams. But the thing that we probably, a point would be good to wrap up on is, what's the saying? Be alert, not afraid, or be alarmed, not alert, not alarmed, or something like that.
Absolutely.
We've all got these vulnerabilities. They're going to exist regardless of how much we do, how many different processes and procedures we put in place to protect ourselves. We all have them. So we shouldn't, you know, don't stop buying stuff online because you've got a vulnerability, but do your homework. Make sure there's the S in the HTTP, which is it's a secure site, and see if you can verify the site some other way. We don't have to live our lives with our head in the sand or in locked in our home with all the windows and curtains shut.
I absolutely think that is a really good point to finish on as this introduction, because there are so many, as I said, there's so many things we're going to talk about with vulnerability. But I think when we get to that point, we say, well, what do we do about it? We don't hide away.
No.
We don't, you know, the idea of being visible is a vulnerability. If we're visible to a predator, if we've got an online presence, we're on Facebook, we're going to be vulnerable to a predator because we get so much garbage come through Facebook.
If they don't know we exist, they can't do anything to us.
No, but they can fish for us through things that they know people will be accessing to. And I don't want to surrender my access to my, you know, friends from all around the world that I use Facebook to keep in contact with, because I'm vulnerable to getting toilet brushes in the mail for $700. Yeah. I want to be aware of that vulnerability and that risk so I can use it for my purposes. And I think, you know, when we talk about what we do about it, sort of the two-step sort of, or the things to understand is, you know, one is that old statement, caveat emptor, buyer beware. So, and I'm not just talking about it in the vulnerability of my toilet brush incident, but I talk about that in the context of if we're aware of the vulnerability, if we're aware of a transaction could take place in which we could not benefit from it because of certain circumstances, that's half the battle, knowing that. So caveat emptor, I think, is a good way to explore that, then we have that empowerment. And then, you know, the other thing to recognize is when we do that and we remove the extent to which we are vulnerable to becoming a victim, there are no victims if there are no victims. If we remove that risk factor to the extent we can, remember we can never eliminate all risk, but the more we do that, there are no victims if there are no victims.
Yep.
Yeah, and in many ways, not all, we are never going to eliminate predators from our society, not in our lifetime.
No.
So there are always going to be them. But predators and victims and scams and individual experiences like this in many ways are a factor of supply and demand in some ways.
Yeah, for sure.
Yep. Predators will go to fertile ground, and that's why they'll do internet scams and do telephone scams and whatever else, because so many of the world's population, 8 billion, 100 million, whatever there is of us, have access to the internet.
Yep.
6 billion of us have Facebook or whatever it might be. So therefore, that's going to be the fertile ground.
Yeah.
If there was no Facebook, there'd be no Facebook scams. If there was no online dating, there'd be no online dating scams,
yep.
And so forth. So I think that's something to be aware of. The more we become aware, the more we understand, the more we protect ourselves, is not to eliminate our access or our visibility or our desirability as or whatever. It's to eliminate our vulnerability under those circumstances.
To the extent that we can do that.
To the extent we can, yep. Absolutely. So I'm looking forward to exploring this more. As I said,
yes.
This is something I'm incredibly passionate about, and right in the middle of production of a book on the notion of vulnerability and its use in ideologically motivated sexual grooming in the global south. So it's something that's right top of mind for me. So I'm really excited, really looking forward to the next few episodes of this topic.
I'm looking forward to that conversation revolving around the seven stage model of that grooming. It's a fascinating model, and I think the history of it's fascinating when you realize it was a coffee conversation that was never meant to be a book chapter that became a book chapter, and now it's actually seen some international success.
It's an embarrassing progress. It's like when you you throw your pumpkin seeds out the window, and 6 months later, the whole side of your house is full of pumpkins. It's kind of what that model became. So maybe I should call it the pumpkin model.
Well, we'll be walking you through that in intimate detail in episodes to come. So thanks for joining us, and I will talk to you next time.
See you next time.